The GW Law School is enormously grateful to Chairman Simons for the opportunity to co-chair this session, and we're profoundly grateful for the opportunity to begin the program today. To get us started, I want to address three topics. I want to talk about the major ways in which the world competition policy, data protection, and consumer protection have changed since the mid-1990s when Bob Patofsky convened his famous set of hearings. Second, I'd like to talk about how the FTC has adapted to these changes and to describe its engagement with foreign institutions, including partner agencies around the world. And then third, to think about some possible adjustments to the FTC's tools and practices that might enable it to better address these adjustments going ahead. My perspective today is based on really three activities. First, my work here as Molly and Chairman Simons mentioned at the FTC in several earlier incarnations. Second, my work with a number of new competition systems around the world. And third, my experience with the Competition and Markets Authority in the United Kingdom, where I've served as and currently serve as a non-executive director. I don't speak on behalf of the CMA today, but my experience there deeply informs the way in which foreign jurisdictions see the United States and perceive the work of the FTC, and shapes my views about how the FTC's role can be enhanced in the world going ahead. Let's start with the past and look back. Both Randy and Chairman Simons have done this already. I'll just underscore a couple of developments that are certainly extraordinary to anyone of my age, but I think would be extraordinary upon reflection to anyone. First is the adjustment in the number of new systems, and we'll take competition law as an example. In 1995, there were roughly 70 jurisdictions with competition laws. This itself was a dramatic jump from 1989, when there were, depending on how you count them, about 30. Today, we have more than 130. That's an extraordinary change in a short period of time. And for those of my age who would have predicted, say, when they were finishing school a little while ago, that this would have happened during their lifetimes, that would have been most improbable. A truly astonishing adjustment in the global scheme. Some of the jurisdictions that we regard today as enormously significant because of their activity, for their influence on the global framework, either had extremely weak systems in place in 1995, or they had none at all. Those with nascent or older frameworks that were getting underway include Brazil, India, Mexico, South Africa, South Korea. You can't have a conversation about global competition policy today without accounting for the extraordinary work that these institutions have done. Others had no system at all, most notably China, but the extremely influential system in Asia, Singapore, had no competition law. And we've witnessed a dramatic increase in the number of cross-border alliances, international networks to promote the development and improvement of competition law, to set international standards, to promote the conversation. Simply to take Africa alone, the development of international enforcement bodies like COMESA, the development of soft law networks like the African Competition Forum, simply emblematic of what you see on continent by continent in the exceptional development of new institutions, both for enforcement, but as all of our presenters have said so far today, for policy development. The International Competition Network did not exist in 1995. ICEPEN, which Chairman Simons has mentioned, was underway, but it was a very nascent organization and hadn't attained the level of prominence that it had now. All these things have taken place in the last 25 years. Technological change, which was always present in the system. It's not new to our lives. It's a conceit of the modern age that these things have never happened before. You look at the first decade of the Federal Trade Commission, and it's dealing with upheaval from remarkable new transportation technologies like the automobile, the airplane, communications revolutions brought about by the telephone, the wireless. No, that's a different wireless, but it was called the wireless at that time, thanks to Mr. Marconi. Entertainment revolutions called the moving picture, and soon to be called the talking picture. All of these things take place, and you look at the agenda of the FTC in its first decade, and it's filled with difficult efforts to wrestle with these changes. Those changes were no less remarkable to the citizens of this country at that time than all the changes we see today are to us. But I think we can assert that the absolute and relative rate of technological change is greater now, and that's changed the mix of issues that have come to the top of the agenda. The upheaval in information technology, for example, has lifted the prominence of privacy, a longstanding concern of policymaking in the low-tech days, but now simply perhaps the preeminent regulatory issue of our time, most notably identified by the extraordinary regulatory developments we see around the world, significantly the European Union's adoption of the General Data Protection Regulation in the recent past. Agencies have engaged in a remarkable process of innovation and adjustment in the face of all of these changes. We've seen major restructurings. The agency with which I'm a non-executive director, the Competition and Markets Authority, is a good example. It took two predecessor institutions, combined them into one. Country by country, France, Spain, Portugal, nation after nation have rethought the fundamental structure through which they offer policy, and they've undertaken major upgrades and capabilities. And quite significantly, I think a broad lesson we derive from international experience is that if you're not revisiting the adequacy of your framework every 5 years at a minimum, you're missing a good game. You're probably not doing your job properly because the array of changes in the world today dictate those changes. If commercial institutions are going to be proficient at innovation and change, the public institutions entrusted with their oversight have to be no less inventive, no less dynamic. And we see in so many areas globally those changes taking place. We also see the adoption, quite important for the FTC, I think, of complex mandates for individual institutions. If we take the 130 plus jurisdictions today that have competition laws, over half of them assign that institution something other than competition law. It's a misnomer to describe them today as competition agencies simpliciter. They actually are diversified policy conglomerates. And the most common adjunct to competition law in these jurisdictions is consumer protection. And in the modern world, I think it is a decided advantage and obligation of jurisdictions like the FTC to consider the significance of this multidimensional role of a growing number of agencies, and to consider perhaps as a priority how to work in particular with agencies with a similar configuration, with the aim of exploiting the full value inherent in that multidimensional mandate, and to use that as a basis for rolling out larger programs over time. What's the significance of all of these changes? Well, the complexity of the framework has obviously grown. Many more institutions with mandates that make a difference around the world. And a growing number of jurisdictions which, through their individual initiative, have the capacity to set what amount to global standards. Any single nation in that framework has a keen interest in seeing those standards developed in a way that is good for citizens globally, as well, in our own parochial case, for the citizens of the United States. The complexity at one level might seem frightening, but it does have a striking advantage. To have so many jurisdictions and in so many instances exceedingly capable people working on trying to solve common problems provides a host of natural experiments from which we might derive conclusions about what might work better in the United States and indeed what the appropriate framework for global oversight might be. In short, a benefit of the complexity of activity, the bewildering activity that we see today, is a remarkable opportunity to measure and assess which kinds of practices might be well adopted on a global basis. And you look at the experience of the US agencies, you notice how in areas such as merger guidelines, the Department of Justice leniency program, the US agencies had no power to force anybody else to adopt these programs. They didn't. By persuasion, they gained broad adoption so that leniency and mandatory merger review with a vocabulary created in the DOJ 1982 guidelines, those are universal features of the way in which we work today, all by persuasion, all by adoption, by no element of compulsion. So this is the framework that brings us to the point. How's the FTC adapted to this? To a striking degree, and I'm not a neutral observer here. I have a pride in the way that which the agency has run, and I'm a fond observer of so many initiatives that it's developed that you can count me as a faintly biased observer here, though always speaking the truth. So a bias that predisposes me to like what the FTC has done here, but of course, a truth seeker that I am, always completely accurate. One thing that we identified that's extremely important here is the development of the Office of International Affairs. One of the most farsighted things that Debbie Majoras did during her tenure as chair is to foster the creation of that office, to assemble a number of different units within the agency and place them in a single place with Randy Tritel as its head. I don't have perhaps a current accurate account, but my guess is that the total number of people dedicated to that office now exceeds 20 and perhaps 25, roughly in that neighborhood. Ponder that for a moment. In 1979, when I was a young person and I had my first exposure to the Federal Trade Commission as a case handler, the total amount of FTC effort dedicated to international liaison was one half of one work year. That's basically one half of one person's time in 1979. In its place, you now have the extraordinary infrastructure. In a way, it's always made me nervous because I feared a legislative overseer or another might say, why are we doing this? Well, Randy and the chairman have described why we do this. This was a far-sighted decision to build an infrastructure that would be indispensable over time to functioning in this new world of complexity. And in a far-sighted way, Debbie Majoras and her successors gave support to that effort so that at the moment, it's unsurpassed as an institution for doing work in this area. There are a number of international offices that do superb work. I see one of them at the CMA, but when I think of the FTC, I think of the story that I saw in a newspaper and during a visit to St. Petersburg where the curator of the Hermitage Museum is asked, do you have the best collection of art in the world? And he hesitates and says, well, it's a hard question to answer. A lot of museums have a good collection. Then he pauses and says, I can assure you of one thing. We are not the second. And when you look at the FTC's OIA team, it is certainly not the second. Another key element that's developed that time, and again, this is truly generated from the staff level up in a thoughtful way and supported by the agency, is SafeWeb. SafeWeb created an indispensable element of the infrastructure that supports international cooperation today, both for the purpose of information sharing and crucially, it's bilateral information sharing. It's the FTC saying, help us abroad and we commit ourselves to help you here too. And that promise has been fulfilled. But I'd underscore one other item that Chairman Simons mentioned, and that is the International Fellows Program. One of the best ways to educate others about what happens here and to build the human glue that holds together international relations are exchange programs. And in a remarkable way, the FTC has brought foreign visitors to the FTC and with very few restrictions has allowed them to see everything that takes place here. Attend meetings, go to case handling meetings, watch the development of the individual case and the policy that goes along with it. If you want to build an environment that has the trust that is indispensable to the deeper level of cooperation that will facilitate better work on cases, better policy development, it starts first and foremost with human relationships. Not simply protocols or other ways of doing work, it is the human relationships that cause people to trust each other. This is a long-term growth. This is a decided investment in the future. But that investment in building those relationships through the Fellows Program, among others, is an active faith and commitment in the future that creates the environment in which you ultimately get a better result and the basis for sharing information and cooperating more broadly. Then there the building of the bilateral relationships, already referred to by Randy and Chairman Simons. The one-on-one engagement and discussion over time that, again, is essential if you're going to have a program that promotes the development of common approaches, understanding of where differences arise, and the gradual progress towards a common result. The contributions to the networks, the ICN, the OECD, UNCTAD, ICEPEN, were it not for the work of the individual agencies, including the FTC, this couldn't possibly have happened. The ICN may be a virtual network, but the work is real. And the only way the work takes place is through human beings committing themselves to do it. I look at the work that Commissioner Boswell and his colleagues at the Bureau in Canada did. Had it not been for Canada providing a virtual secretariat, there would be no ICN over time. And to look, and I'm aware of the dedication of effort at the FTC by its professional staff, by the Office of International Affairs, I will further add that if the Canadian Bureau is one pillar indispensable to the ICN, the FTC is a supporting buttress that was equally important to keeping the ICN working and successful. That was a real and far-sighted commitment. Technical assistance. To sum up, the style. The concern, I think, when Americans go abroad is that they're loud, they're dogmatic, they're doctrinaire. They're occasionally right, but they're never in doubt. So that you worry about exactly what course they're taking and what they have to say. The technical assistance program I've seen going back to its origins, by contrast, thoughtful, sustaining. What's been the role of the advisors? Like the wait staff in the restaurant. We give you a menu. Here are the choices that we have here. Then comes the moment where someone asks, well, what's good? And then there's the opportunity to say, what do you like? What do you want? I can describe for you what might be good. And then to give you a view of what happens. But the listening and the advisory process has been thoughtful and sustaining. I look at the work, for example, done in the Baltics, which I visit on a regular basis to see the three members of the EU who have competition agencies there. And I'm struck by how people my age and those agencies come to me and ask me about how well FTC and DOJ staff people that they worked with are doing. I can't give you a rigorous proof for this, but I think a crucial force in the development of so many agencies around the world was the advice and guidance that FTC and DOJ officials provided. That was a far-sighted effort. And a modern example of that is the work that the FTC has done in conjunction with Canada, the European Union, Germany, OECD, and UNCTAD. Footnote, that's a remarkable constellation of common effort that has not always characterized technical assistance, but it happened here. One reason that a first-rate management team and leadership group at the Ukraine Anti-Monopoly Commission has a fighting chance to succeed in exceedingly difficult circumstances is that technical assistance over time. And it's not having someone bring their PowerPoint slides up and run through them, being cautious if they might be to take the name of the previous city at which they gave them off the slide. I saw a presenter in Latin America give a slide that said, "Welcome to Singapore." Not the sort of stale, blow the dust off your notes from the last talk, but hands-on guidance to case handlers about how you actually do the job. And if you purport to talk about merger control and you've never worked on a merger, they should chase you out of the room. And instead, the habit has been in technical assistance to provide the right person to give the right advice at the right moment. And last, I think we've seen as part of the interaction, we've seen better disclosure. And there's been a decided process of learning from abroad. In matters such as Carnival Cruise Lines, I think the FTC, through its engagement with the European Union, came to see that when you close a significant matter, you ought to say why. When you issue a second request, when you issue a subpoena, when you use compulsory process, you ought to explain why you decided not to take further steps. And the habit, not in every case to be sure, but in a growing number of prominent matters, to say why the FTC had decided not to act takes root in this period. And that's a process of very helpful learning. Well, some thoughts about the future. I want to put things in three baskets. What the FTC can do on its own, what the FTC can do with the cooperation of other institutions, and last, how the Congress has to help out. First, what can the FTC do on its own? I think a valuable part of these proceedings is the opportunity for the FTC in talking to other institutions around the world to take stock of its own capabilities. It has a scalable mandate that is unique among US institutions and, I would assert, among institutions globally. It has three policy domains, which increasingly become important in resolving difficult problems: antitrust, consumer protection, and privacy. It has distinctive information gathering tools, and yes, it is an adjudication body as well. Does the United States have a specialized trade regulation court? The answer is it does, and it's in this building. So how can this constellation of activities be applied in a way that offer better policy results? As a starting point, I'd sustain the existing level of commitment to the Office of International Affairs and Things International. It's not just the work of OIA, but it's all of the FTC specialists that can draw in to support projects over time. I would say there's room for better education abroad. I'm somewhat dispirited when I go to international meetings and engage in them to see the level of ignorance I see about what the FTC does and how it operates and works. I think that a fuller effort in international fora to explain that, the speeches, the papers for OECD, the engagement on working groups, would be a way to make this story better known. To make clear, in other words, how the FTC functions and operates as a way of increasing understanding about how policy is made here. So one recommendation is the fuller effort as an educator. I'm struck in discussions about privacy how a continuing refrain is the U.S. doesn't have a privacy regime. Well, it does. It's not as complete, comprehensive. It does. And in the places where it exists, it can bite you pretty hard if you don't pay attention to it. I think that kind of education is an important focus of what the FTC might do in the future. Second element, better disclosure, more closing statements. My dentist says at certain moments, this is going to hurt a little. Imagine where we would be in the public debate about dominant firm behavior if the FTC statement in Google, the closing statement, had been more elaborate and coherent. A fuller discussion about what happened and why. And with the inadvertent disclosure of the other memos, might it have been a good idea just to put the whole lot out there? Put them all out there. Read them all, the memos. See where the recommendations were. Yes, you extract what has to be extracted, but you put them out there, you have a much more intelligent debate about the choice and decision that the agency made in that instance. Release them. Better disclosure of broader strategy, using every opportunity to make clear what the overall purpose of the program is and how it's been designed over time. So fuller disclosure. Technical assistance. I would expand the FTC's efforts to focus even more on what I would call the elements of administrative law. One of the most important ingredients of good policy development that I learned in my time at the agency is the critical quality of a good administrative process. A good general counsel's office that handles conflicts of interest, a good mechanism for teaching ethics, a good mechanism for organizing the flow of information through the system. There's not an institution on earth that does not need that infrastructure in order to succeed. And the FTC has an extraordinary reservoir of know-how about how to do those things and do them well. And to build a structure without building them in from the front is a source of failure. And yes, as these proceedings are doing, I would continue my process of evaluation, especially by talking to our foreign counterparts and asking them, how are we doing? Is this working well? What could be better? And to do that on a regular basis, and I think there is the trust and understanding that exists that in the right setting at the right time, you can get informative observations from those individuals. What things require cooperation with other institutions? For this audience and for my colleagues, I turn back to a theme very briefly that concerns me a lot, is coherence between the Department of Justice and the FTC. There should be a routine process by which no head of the institution gives a speech without sharing a text with the other institution. I plead guilty in this respect. I didn't do that when I was here. Tom Barnett, my dear colleague from the Department of Justice, I don't think Tom ever got a speech in advance for me. He certainly didn't get part of PowerPoints, partly because those are being prepared the night before at the conference site. That's one reason. But even there, I didn't walk them over. I didn't say, Tom, let's have coffee. Let me tell you about what I'm going to say. Good, bad, or indifferent. I didn't do that. How hard would that have been to do? Because a view that I think that persists internationally is, who's speaking for the United States? What is this? If
5 members of the Federal Trade Commission, 3 members, the head of the Antitrust Division. What is this constellation of participants, always starting with the caveat, I don't speak for the United States. Well, but of course you do. In some way, it's a basis for inferring what's going on. Would it not be possible for there to be a collective effort by the two institutions to formulate an approach to say, what are our themes overseas and how are you going to drive them home? Second element, international cooperation. I think there is a benefit to building on a model that works so well with Canada. And I think about Commissioner Boswell and his colleagues. The extent to which the U.S.-Canada relationship was a prototype through building an effective cross-border approach to consumer protection. All of the work that went in, meeting after meeting, simply first to learn what the other configuration looked like, to learn who did what. How many FTC people knew in advance what the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had to do with this process, or local police, or the Bureau. That was a process of learning. But over years, it became a foundation for an exceedingly well-functioning process of cooperation. I would take as a starting point the institutions that have a similar configuration, mandate, similar responsibilities. My list, the ACCC in Australia, the CMA in the UK, and a step in that direction, further step taken today, as Joe Simons mentioned, Canada, New Zealand, and Singapore. What do they have in common? Yes, these are all English-speaking peoples. They all have a common program in many respects, many common roots, though variations. I'd put it this way. If you can't test and prototype programs with the government of Canada, our beloved colleagues close by, if you can't do it with the ACCC, with the CMA, with New Zealand, with Singapore, if you can't build a common approach or understanding with those, and they all understand the special considerations that go into managing a multi-dimensional policy mandate, how are you going to do it with the rest of the world? I devote a lot more effort to working with those to build prototypes that can be rolled out and developed more broadly elsewhere. I would work with my partners overseas in more detail on case reconstructions to look at commonly examined files and ask after the fact what happened. What evidence did we think was important? Why, if we did we come to different results? For international organizations, for international cooperation, I'd think of the example that France and Germany have pioneered in data protection and the digital economy to doing studies together. Might the Bureau in Canada and the FTC be engaged in that kind of common effort? Might the FTC and the ACCC, the CMA, find projects that become useful not simply for advancing the state of knowledge, but building the relationships that make cooperation more effective over time? And last, domestic networks might be enhanced. Striking impression I have from my time abroad is how much different jurisdictions devote by way of effort and personnel to taking discrete elements of their framework and working together with them. The United Kingdom Competition Network, which joins up the CMA with a number of sectoral regulators. The European Competition Network, which the Europeans have used with great effect and success in not just building a common understanding of what's happening, but moving toward the direction of a common policy. Is it not possible for the US to do something similar here on a way that provides more coherence and focus for what it does overseas? Last, Congress, what must it do? It's got to renew SafeWeb with no footnotes attached, unconditional, permanent renewal. New privacy law, comprehensive FTC mandate with no jurisdictional carve-outs. It's impossible to engage effectively internationally if that change doesn't take place. Foreign citizens as FTC employees, I'd reconsider the restriction. It's a global talent pool, and I say day in and day out in all my meetings of the CMA and elsewhere, it's an incredible global talent pool. To not be able to draw from it is simply ignoring an enormously valuable source of personnel. And last, I'd change the Sunshine Act so that the FTC commissioners can consult and discuss in the same way that their counterparts do overseas, at least with respect to the formulation of strategy and policy over time. To sum up, these hearings are a great opportunity for the FTC to assess its international strategy. And importantly, I think, to reinforce the intuition that guided the formation of OIA and the building of the modern program. An agency has a choice every day to consume or invest. By consume, I mean you spend money on cases, you do regulations. Invest means you build the infrastructure that serves over time. John Fingleton at our FTC at 100 hearings said, the problem with this is that the investment in infrastructure does not generate ribbon-cutting opportunities. It does not create the headline, oh, we worked on SafeWeb, thanks. Where's your big tech case? Well, we built a better infrastructure with the International Fellows Program. Yes, 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 yes. The decision to build the infrastructure is important. At the hearings, John said, the investment's important. We probably have to do more of it, but the difficulty is we cannot show in a tangible and concrete way how it has made things better. But I think our experience over time is that it certainly does make things better over time. It's indispensable in this multipolar complex world that we have. During her campaign, Hillary Clinton had a speech in which she talked about planting trees. And she said, the mark of good public administration is the willingness to plant trees whose shade you will never enjoy. And in many respects, that's what the FTC has done. So good luck in taking care of the trees and in planting more seeds. Thank you.